Hello and welcome. You are listening to podcast 2 of the lecture on propositional logic. We resume on slide 26. So far we've introduced the syntax and semantics of propositional logic, and we defined two normal forms and also what it means to decompute the interpretation of a logical formula. Now let's apply this knowledge to create a knowledge base of the Wumpus world. So first, we introduce some logical atoms to denote some elements in our world. So for example, to denote the position of the agent in some field, we use the atom A. When the agent notices a breeze on a field, we use the atom B. G stands for glitter and gold. OK means that a square is safe. P is a pit. Stench means S means that the agent notices some stench on a field. V means we have visited this field before. And W stands for the Wumpus. So now let's start writing down in propositional logic everything that we know in the initial state. So here we see our grid world again, and of course we need to number the individual cells, for example, give them some arbitrary names, and here we simply use a coordinate system to actually write down all possible perceptions for the cells that we can say something about. So what happens? So in the initial state, we know that the agent is in A11. It does not notice a breeze and it does not notice stench. So A11 is true, not breeze 11 is false, and not stench on 11 is false. Now we have to encode all the possible rules in this world. So for example, if an agent is in a cell 11, then this implies that the agent has visited the cell 11. And we have, of course, as we can only express atoms in this logic, we have to actually write this rule down for all possible cells in this grid world. So if the agent is on cell 21, it has visited cell 21, and so on and so forth. Then there is a rule that tells us what happens when we notice stench, or what can we actually conclude. So when we notice stench in 11, then we know that the Wumpus is either in 12 or in 21. Similarly, we need to write a rule for all these other cells. So when we notice stench in 12, then we have to write down again the disjunction of the neighboring cells. We also define a rule for what we can conclude when we notice breeze. So if there's breeze in 11, we know that there must be a pit in 12 or in P1. So similarly, again to stench, we write down this rule for each cell where we can notice a breeze. So now we can also actually formulate the safe side of this rule. So if we do not know stench, in 11, then we can safely assume that the Wumpus is not in cell 12, and it will also not be in cell 21. Furthermore, if we do not notice breeze in 11, we also know that there is no pit in 12 or in 21. So now, how can the agent actually find out that it can move forward? We can safely move forward if the OK statement on a cell is true. So we have the initial observations of our agent. Agent is in 11, there is no breeze in 11, there is no stench in 11. And how can the agent now actually conclude that the cell 21 and the cell 12 are OK? And to do this, it will actually need to apply the rules that it has available in its knowledge base that actually tell the agent how this world functions. So this means now we have to apply some of these rules. And let's now learn how we can do this. Slide 27 introduces a concept that is called entailment. We define that a knowledge base, KB, entails a formula phi if the formula phi follows from the knowledge base or if the formula is valid in this knowledge base. And this is possible if phi is true in all models of this knowledge base. So the entailment means that let's assume we have a conjunction of formulas psi in the knowledge base. We have the set of models for this knowledge base. Then this must be a subset of the models of phi. Now we can formulate a contradiction theorem that will make it much easier to determine if a formula phi follows from a knowledge base. And interestingly, we can say that a formula phi follows from a knowledge base if and only if the negation of phi added to this knowledge base is unsatisfiable. This is called the contradiction theorem. So let's look at the proof argumentation why this theorem is valid. So our theorem formulates an equivalence. So it says if phi is valid in a knowledge base, then it's adding its negation to this knowledge base renders the knowledge base unsatisfiable. So this is one direction of this equivalence implication. From left to right. We also have to show the other direction. If the knowledge base that contains not phi is unsatisfiable, then actually the original formula phi is entailed by this knowledge base. So let's look at the two argumentations for both directions. The argument is essentially based on knowing that an interpretation cannot make a formula and its negation true at the same time. So let's assume phi is valid in our knowledge base. Then we know that any interpretation that satisfies this knowledge base will also satisfy our formula phi. And this means that it cannot satisfy the negation of phi. So this would mean that, of course, then adding this negation to the knowledge base would make everything unsatisfiable. Now let's look in the other direction. We know that we have no interpretation that makes the knowledge base and not phi true. So now this means that any knowledge base that would any interpretation which would make our knowledge base true or which satisfies the knowledge base means that this interpretation cannot also at the same time entail the formula not phi. As it does not entail the formula not phi, it must therefore entail the formula phi. So the contradiction theorem helps us to define a very convenient calculus. As shown on slide 28. So how can we find out if a formula follows from a knowledge base? So we can actually use the truth table method, but let's imagine if we have many Boolean variables or atomic formulas, then we actually have to consider 2 to the power of n truth value combinations. So it was still handy to fill in the truth table for 2 atoms in the previous example. We can maybe also do this for 3, but then it would very quickly explode. So this is not really a method that we can compute efficiently. So but using the contradiction theorem, we can actually try to derive with the help of inference rules our calculus that actually taking the knowledge base and adding the negation of the formula that we want to show to this knowledge base and showing that we arrive at a logical contradiction. So when adding the negation of phi to the knowledge base, we can derive the atom false. And this, once we have established such a derivation in a calculus, then we actually know that phi follows from our knowledge base. So let's now look at an inference rule a calculus, or sometimes also called a deduction, that allows us how do we can actually derive true formulas from existing true formulas. Yeah, we've already introduced tautologies, which are true in all interpretations, and our inference rules are such tautologies. So whenever a formula is true, then it will actually allow us to derive another true formula. A famous example of such an inference rule is modus ponens. So if we know that phi is true, and we also know that phi implies psi, then we can actually conclude psi. You've maybe already heard for the famous statement, Socrates is a man, all men. If somebody is a man, then it is mortal, so then we can actually conclude Socrates is mortal. We can more conveniently express this in a more general way in predicate logic, but it's also expressible in propositional logic. So we can actually write these inference rules as implications, but very often we also need and use a notation where we write the antecedent of the rule on the top. Then comes this line, and we write the conclusion at the bottom. So now a calculus consists of a set of inference rules. And with these rules, we can derive a so-called deduction and perform deductive reasoning. A derivation in a calculus is a sequence of applied inference rules. Two important properties of a calculus are soundness and completeness, as defined on slide 30. A formula phi can be derived from a knowledge base using a calculus R. So we write actually here the symbol with vertical line and a horizontal line, and this is the derivation sign. So applying a number of rules from the calculus, we can derive phi. So now we actually state the relationship between the derivation in a calculus and the entailment relation that we defined earlier. So a calculus R is sound if and only if all derivable formulas follow logically. So we can only derive in this calculus formulas that are actually entailed by our knowledge base. A calculus is complete if all the formulas that we can actually that actually follow from a knowledge base can or are entailed by it can actually be derived in this calculus. The calculus is sound and complete if both properties hold. So if a knowledge base entails a formula, we can derive it, and also the other direction. So if we derive it, it is definitely also entailed by the knowledge base. So a simple calculus to actually do these kind of computations, which is also then in the end sound and complete, is based on resolution. So we begin here on slide 31 to introduce a rule that is called unit resolution. So now we actually need the representation of formulas as clauses. Remember that a clause is a disjunction of literals, and we also have a single literal, the so-called unit clause. Yeah, remember that a literal is either an atomic formula or a negated atomic formula. And given a clause and a unit clause, we can produce a new clause, the so-called resolvent. So you see the resolution rule depicted here. So given the clause from L1 to LK and the unit clause M, we actually derive at the resolvent at the bottom, assuming that the literal Li and the unit clause M are complementary literals. One is the negation of the other. The resolvent contains a single copy of all literals except Li and M. However, note that the unit clause M remains available in the knowledge base for further resolution steps. We can generalize this rule further on slide 32. So we can actually also apply resolution between non-unit clauses containing complementary literals. So here you see two clauses, L and M. And now we actually match these clauses, and the resulting clause only contains one copy of each literal. Yeah, it is important to note that you can only resolve a single pair of complementary literals at each step. So here we actually assume that the complementary literals are Li and Mj. And let's now look at some examples. A correct resolution is if you take A or B and not B, and then you know actually that A follows. And here I've not used the clause notation. I've really used the logical formula representation to make this clear. You can actually take all these formulas, fill in the truth tables again, and see that these are in fact valid resolution or inference rules. So if we have given a formula A or B or P or Q and not P or not Q, in the next step we can, for example, to decide to resolve on Q, Q and not Q. So this leads to the formula A or B or P and not P. An incorrect application of the resolution rule is shown at the bottom, where we resolve P and not P and Q and not Q at the same time. You can convince yourself that this resolution step is not correct when you actually fill in the truth table again. Slide 33 introduces clause notation. We arrive at clauses and formulas in conjunctive form when we apply our equivalences. And it is actually a convenient idea to use a set-like notation. So we know that the conjuncts in a formula of conjunct forms conjunctive normal form are only containing disjuncts, and between the various conjuncts we have the conjunctive symbol. So we can actually replace the AND or connective by commas, and we keep the clauses separated, standing for the various conjuncts in the conjunctive normal form by these parentheses. So now we actually have the so-called set notation, and you see that it is compact and actually quite handy. So here we again also see the application of a resolution rule. So we have the formula now in set notation, and we resolve on the literal Q. Let's look at a larger example on slide 34. Our knowledge base contains a number of applications. So for example, from Q we can conclude that not P is true. From not P we can conclude that either not Q or not R or not S hold. And then we have the formula that not Q implies not S, and we also have that when not R holds, then we also know not S. Now we actually want to show that the formula phi not S is entailed by this knowledge base. So to do so, we take the negation of phi S, add it to the knowledge base, and show that we can actually derive the so-called empty clause from it, which stands for the symbol false. So we first transform our knowledge base into conjunctive normal form. So we have already the conjuncts of the various rules. The rules are implications. We can rewrite these implications using the equivalence for the implication formula. So Q implies not P becomes not Q or not P, for example. So now we transform this formula into the more compact clause notation, and we add the negation of phi to it. So you see here we have the various clauses. We have not Q, not P as a clause, and so on. And we have also the negation of phi, which is S, as a single clause. We can now apply a number of unit resolution steps. Our formula phi is an atom, so it only the clause only contains the atom S. It's therefore a unit clause. And now we can actually resolve this unit clause with a number of other clauses. For example, the second, the third, and the fourth clause, because in all these formulas, S occurs in a negated way. So this leads to an iteration or transformation of all our knowledge base, where we have the blue formulas actually being shortened by S. So now we actually have two more unit clauses that resolved from these unit clause resolution steps, namely Q and R. Let's assume we decide to do another unit resolution, namely on Q and not Q. This leads us to the change clause P and not R. Or let's rather say P or not R. So now we can actually do another unit resolution with the unit clause R. This leads us now to a new unit clause, namely P, because P or not R and R resolves to P. So now our knowledge base only contains unit clauses, and by now resolving not P and P, we can derive the empty clause, which represents false. The algorithm that we just applied to use this derivation is summarized on slide 35. So resolution takes a knowledge base and a query, the clause we want to show that it is entailed by our knowledge base. It computes a conjunctive normal form representation of the knowledge base to which we added the negated query. And then we actually loop through our clauses and always try to compute resolvents. So in our case, we only needed to apply the unit resolution rule, but we can in general resolve between two arbitrary clauses. Once if we encounter among the resolvents the empty clause, then we know that actually alpha is entailed by our knowledge base and this algorithm returns true. If we cannot derive any new clauses, then at one point we will be stuck and we cannot do any new resolution steps and then return false. Otherwise, if we have derived a new resolvent that we haven't seen yet in the clause, we add this new clause to the sets of clauses and we continue to apply resolution steps. With this, let me end this podcast.